Thank you. Thank you all for coming out. I was supposed to be at the last presentation, but I got the days mixed up and everything. But that worked out well because it gave me a chance to do this particular lecture, which is not on the series list of lectures, and it's one that I think is very important. The Forks of the Road, of course, is a very important place for in the state of Mississippi for the auctioning of enslaved Africans. But what I want to talk about is what Africans were brought to Mississippi. You see, one of the fundamental things that we overlook and is often misunderstood and often not taught is the fact that all of the Africans who were brought to the Americas came from someplace. They belonged to a particular nation. I don't like to use the term tribes. Tribes is a colonial term that was applied by European colonial powers in Africa because they didn't want to recognize the various nations of Africans as nations. So they came up with this notion of tribes. But it's very difficult to have 350, 400,000 people and be considered a tribe. So that's one of the things I wanted to point out to you up front. But particularly, the largest nation of Africans that was brought to the Louisiana territories under which what we now think of as Mississippi existed were a group of people called the Bambara. Now, if your people are from Mississippi, then there is a high probability that you are descendants of the Bambara. And this particular lecture is going to focus exclusively on them. And I'm going to provide you with some very interesting insights. First, you have to understand that the territory that we're talking about was French territory, the French Louisiana territory. The state that we live in right now, Illinois, was a part of the French Louisiana territories. This is why we know that the first settler here in the city of Chicago, Ishikagu as they called it, which means wild onion, was Jean-Baptiste Pointe du Sable. All right. Du Sable is the first settler here in the city of Chicago. He was a Haitian, a black man from Haiti. And of course, if you ever go down to the Tribune Plaza downtown on Michigan Avenue, they have an actual statue there of his image, a bronze statue of him down there in commemoration of that particular historical reality. So we see here that in French America, or New France as it was called, this was a frontier land, a borderland that consisted of all of these major valleys, the St. Lawrence Valley in Canada, the Acadia in Nova Scotia, the Great Lakes, the Illinois County, the Lower Mississippi Valley. And colonial Louisiana was under the administration of two different European powers. You had the French, who were here first from 1699 to 1763, and then you had Spain from 1763 to 1800. And this is very important because there are a lot of places that you'll go to in what was known as French Louisiana that when it was taken over by the Spanish, particularly if you go to, say, a place like New Orleans and you go to the French Quarter, you'll find on the streets, they'll say that at one time this street was known as Rue des Royales. And then when the Spaniards came in, they called it Calle des Royales, all right? That is a royal street. And so this was very, very common, and there's a lot of history behind that that we won't have time to go into right now. So before being sold to the United States in 1803 by Napoleon, the reason why it was sold to Napoleon in 1803, and this is a part of history that you're never taught about in your history classes in school, and that's this. All of you have learned about the Louisiana Purchase, have you not? You heard about that, right? But I bet you don't know why the Louisiana Purchase got purchased, why the Louisiana territories got purchased. Well, you have to understand that when after Napoleon lost two great battles, Napoleon lost, and the French lost their most important and wealthiest property in the Western Hemisphere, and that was Haiti. Haiti was the moneymaker for Spain, for France, and it made France the wealthiest nation in the Western Hemisphere. But because of the fact that Toussaint Louverture, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, and Henri Christophe, and those particular Africans defeated Napoleon's army in Haiti, they had to give up Haiti. Not only did they lose Haiti and the resources in Haiti, but that was the reason why Napoleon's army also lost the Battle of Waterloo, because his crack troops got defeated in Haiti. And so, since Napoleon was broke, Thomas Jefferson was able to go to Napoleon and say, look, the conversation probably went something like this. Yo, Nap, let me holler at you for a minute. That's Nap Napoleon. I know you're broke, because I know you're a player, and you got all those ladies that you like to hang out with, but you're broke. And so I know you need some ends, so let me help you out. If you would give me the Louisiana territories, I'll make a good deal for you. So he sold, Napoleon agreed and sold the Louisiana territories to the United States for somewhere in the neighborhood of like $14 million, chump change. Because what the colonies wanted to do was expand to the Pacific so they can do business in areas of the Pacific. But not only that, this was very, very valuable and very, very wealthy territory that they wanted. And so Napoleon was able to sell the Louisiana territories to Thomas Jefferson, and that way they became a part of what later expanded into the United States. Never heard that story before, have you? That's the real deal. That's what really happened. All right, so the Spanish explored the territory of Louisiana as early as 1519 during the De Pineda's expedition, confirming the discovery of Mississippi, that is the Mississippi Valley, and from 1539 to 42 during the DeSoto Overland Expedition. And this information, of course, I got from the Louisiana State Museum in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Very interesting name, Baton Rouge, it means red stick. The French, when they came into what is now known as Louisiana, there was a dispute between like the Choctaw and the Chickasaws, and they divided their land by a tree that they called Itsoma. Itsoma was a name that the French didn't understand, so when they had one of the interpreters who could speak French for them, when they asked him, what does Itsoma mean? And he said, it means Baton Rouge, that is red stick. That's how Baton Rouge in Louisiana, the capital of Louisiana, got its name. If you didn't know, now you know. So Louisiana would not again be of interest to European powers until the late 1600s, when King Louis XIV encouraged further exploration of the Mississippi River. It is from Louis XIV that we get the name Louisiana. It is from the Duke of Orleans that we get the name New Orleans. All right, you get that? All right, so all these things have a history. Every place has a history. All the names mean something. They come from somewhere. And all ideas have an origin. And in order to understand what those things represent, you need to investigate their origins. So in 1619, the first permanent settlement was established by the French at what is now present-day Biloxi. The Biloxi were an indigenous or First Nations group of people who lived in the Mississippi Valley. Of course, very few of the Biloxi even exist anymore, all right? They no longer exist. So we have a real kind of issue with that. The first census at Biloxi counted 5 officers, 2 of which were Canadian, 5 petty officers, 4 sailors, 19 Canadians, 13 pirates from the Caribbean, not pirates of the Caribbean. You see, but they're actually pirates in the Caribbean, whether you know it or not. 10 laborers, 6 cabin boys, and 20 soldiers. From its inception, Louisiana was a low-growing colony due to the lack of financial support it received from the French government and the lack of laborers to build a colony. As a result, many colonists were forcefully persuaded to journey to Louisiana. They needed people. That's why they had to have these people migrate there. And we'll get into who these people were in a minute. By 1682, René Robert Cavalier, Sieur de La Salle, claimed the Mississippi River and all the land surrounding it and naming the territory Louisiana or Louis Land from after King Louis. Now, isn't that interesting? And in the process of making this decision, you know they didn't ask the Biloxi or the Mississippi, all of these indigenous people, what they thought about this. They just took it as if, it was theirs. It was like discovery. You know, we heard the famous story, Columbus discovered America, and of course you can't discover something somebody already on. So obviously you didn't discover it. So in order to populate the area, the French resorted to importing prisoners, beggars, and vagabonds, poor people convicted of minor crimes. This is one of the things we often overlook about the history of the United States, or what we call the United States, and it's the Americas and Australia as well. Both of these places were colonized by Europeans who were essentially prisoners, who were criminals, who were brought to this country because in their own countries, in France and in Great Britain, they couldn't afford to take care of all of these people who were lowly, people who were doing nothing and who were creating problems. And so what they did was put them on ships that were referred to as the Ship of Fools and sent them out into the ocean. And some of them came to this part of the world and some of them went to Australia. All right, so according to Gwendolyn Midler Hall, she's one of the really premier writers on this subject, the French colonization of Louisiana became, to a great extent, a penal colonization. That is, that these places were initially set up as penal colonies. And, you know, I say a penal colony was basically a penitentiary where people would go and never come back. So French prisoners were sentenced to work in Louisiana for 3 years. That was kind of their sentence. Many French citizens involved in what was termed antisocial behaviors were simply deported to the colonies. So if you got out of hand, if you were a thief, if you were a prostitute, if you were involved in something that they consider antisocial or improper behavior, then what they did was, rather, when you got convicted in court, they put you on a ship, they shipped you way over here. All right, so after mounting complaints from the colonial residents and a number of French deaths in the voyage to Louisiana, deportation of French citizens was abolished. Why? Because people were dying. People weren't used to being out there. You're going across the ocean, maybe 2 or 3 months or longer. You're living in horrible conditions. You're probably drinking salt water. Just because there's water out there don't mean it's all drinkable. Salt water is not digestible in many cases. To aid in expanding the colony in terms of people and profits, the John Law Company, later called the Company of the Indies, which also engaged in the slave trade. And one of the things you have to understand is that many of these companies that were very, very instrumental in establishing these colonies also were engaged in the slave trade because slave trading was a business. And records were kept. So people knew whom they got, from where they got them, and where they took them. The notion that they got a bunch of slaves and brought them to the Americas is a false notion. The people that they brought here were not slaves, they were enslaved when they got here. And we're gonna get a little bit deeper into that too in a minute as we understand more about these people. So the law company was given a monopoly of the Louisiana trade for 25 years. Canadian beaver trade in perpetuity, ownership of land and mines, the right to build fortifications, and the right to nominate company directors and colonial officers. So they created a corporation. Now understand, in the process of creating the corporation, they did not ask the indigenous people anything about whether or not they could do this, or if they should be involved in assisting them in this process. Prisoners, American Indians and voluntary settlers did not constitute enough manpower for the French colonists to sustain this strategic outpost for the French Empire. So slaves of African descent were desired as unpaid labor due to the fact that Indian enslavement did not meet the labor demands of the colonists, and they began to realize that it wouldn't work because oftentimes the indigenous people would just run away. And it was very seldom that the French military would go out to after them in the forest to hunt them down. They wouldn't do that because they may not come back. And so the African slaves were also needed as bonds persons to exploit colonial resources to their fullest potential. So of course they needed these people to rape the land and its resources. In the Mississippi Valley, what they call the Mississippi Delta, is one of the most fertile pieces of land in the United States to this very day. And there was just so much that they could grow there. And we'll get into detail about what these particular Africans could grow. So Louisiana census showed that each year the number of slaves of African descent increased, and that by the 1740s, the colony of African population was mainly Creoles or born in America. That's what the word Creole means, Creole. Creole means those Africans who are the descendants of the first Africans who were brought to the United States. That's what it originally means. And of course, I have many pictures of what they call Creole people, you know what I mean? We would call them light-skinned black people today and different types of things like that. But in certain parts of the United States, like if you go to South Carolina, if you go to Louisiana, particularly New Orleans, there's a whole different notion of what that means. But it, fundamentally, this is what it originally meant. And I'll show you other examples of other Creole people as well. So a resurgence in African arrivals would not take place on a large scale again until the 1780s. And what you have to understand is that this part of the United States got perhaps one of the largest shipments of Africans. And I'll show you in a little slide later on where they came from, what ships brought them here, when they were brought them here, where they dropped them off, all that type of stuff, which I think is very important to know. So under Spanish rule during these years, the slave population grew by 250%. And the number of free persons of African descent increased 16-fold because, see, one of the things that's often not talked about is free people of color, sometimes referred to in French as the gens de couleur. All right? These were people who were of African descent, but they had never been enslaved. Most of them were free, and there were many of them. Oftentimes, this is overlooked. So since the Bambara were viewed as warriors, the New World slavocracy had to seriously constrain and the continuation of their warrior traditions, and they had a reputation for being extremely rebellious. And so we'll see that there was a particular period of time where they stopped importing Bambaras because Bambaras were dangerous. Nat Turner was possibly a Bambara. Some say he could have even been earlier a Muslim, but certainly a Bambara. And there were many, many slave revolts. We know about Nat Turner, and we know about Denmark Vesey, but there were literally hundreds of revolts. I gave you the example of Haiti already. There were those in what we call Puerto Rico today. You had Jamaica. All these places, they had these various revolts because people who have been free are not going to just walk easily into slavery. So where did the Bambara come from in Africa? These are old pictures of Bambara, relatively new pictures, and some modern pictures of Bambara people. Specifically of interest is the founding of and settling of Louisiana and the role of people of African descent in this process. Between 1719 and 1731, two-thirds of the African slaves brought to French Louisiana came from the Senegambia. The Senegambia is a region between Senegal and Gambia today on the west coast of Africa around the river, like I said, as I mentioned. So the people who lived in that region and were later transported to be enslaved in Louisiana had an intricate knowledge of rice and corn cultivation, as well as cotton, tobacco, and indigo. No Africans that were brought to these shores to be enslaved came here with no skills. In fact, the people that they brought here, they brought because they did have skills. They brought rice from Africa to be planted here in the United States. No European colonizers brought Africans here and then took them out in the fields and showed them how to plant cotton, plant rice, plant corn, or anything else. These are skills that they had when they came here. And they got those people because those people had those specific skills. And they went looking for those specific people that had those specific skills to do that specific work. And that's very important to know and understand. Because this is what they cultivated on the continent of Africa, where they came from, in the communities where they came from. And they knew those colonial and European powers who went and got them because they knew that's what they did where they came from. And they wanted to do that here. So many people from the Senegambia shared common cultural knowledge as a result of living amongst each other for centuries, and most had converted to Islam, with the exception of the Bambara. There were Muslims who were brought here to the United States with all of the discussion about Islam going on in the news today. What is not always known is the fact that there were Muslims who were blacks who were here in the Americas as far back as the 1500s. And this was something that was important to know. All right? So, the Kingdom of Mali, the Bambara more correctly known as the Bamana, right? Bamana is the original name for the people known as Bambara, were inhabitants of the Kingdom of Mali. Now, the Kingdom of Mali and the country of Mali today are two different things. The Bambara were a large Mande ethnic group located mostly in the country of Mali. Now, what we fail to understand about many nations of Africans is that they come from specific types of language families. All right, so amongst the Mande, you have many groups of or nations of people among whom the Bambara were. It's like the Akan. The Akan, who are like in Ghana, Akan is a name that encompasses a large group of people. You had the Akwamos, you got the Ga, you got several different types of people, but what they all have in common is they all speak languages that are closely associated with one another so that they can easily understand one another. So today they're the largest and dominant people in the country. The Bambara have long influenced the areas in which they live because Fulani, Soninke, Malinke cities and lands were absorbed into the Bambara kingdom. Their cultural influences remain part of the Bambara lifestyle. So among the Bambara, you also have Fulani. Now, the Fulani are very interesting because in Fulani culture, you know, they have a thing, a whole ritual where the women, where the men dress up and make up their faces and dress up and they dance before the women. And the women decide which ones they want to be with. Yeah, that's a flip side of everything we think, isn't it? Yeah, and the men, I mean, they be out there, they dancing, they're smiling, they're all made up, got their face on, as we like to say, right? Make their makeup, and they're dancing and everything and trying to appeal to the different women. And then a woman will pick one. You'll be with me for a year. And if she don't like him, she can trade him in the next year at the next dance and get another one. It's real, I'm just being honest. All right, so they spoke Bamana, which is a Niger-Congo language. Bamanankan, also known as Bambara or Bamanankan, is a member of the Mende group of the Niger-Congo language family. It is spoken by 4 million people as a first language and by another 10 million people in Mali and in its neighboring areas like the Côte d'Ivoire or the Ivory Coast. So you got this large group of people, and it's traditional. Many people on the African continent are usually pretty fluent in 5, 6, 7 different languages, not to mention English or French, or English and French, or Spanish, or depending on whatever colonial power took over that particular part of their territory. Many of them are capable of that. Now, one of the things I want to show here is this slide right here, because one of the other myths that they tell about Africa is that Africans didn't have any language. Well, you will find that many African nations had their own language. And certainly the oldest of the African languages on the continent of Africa is a language that is known in its language as Medunetra, or divine speech, which we commonly call hieroglyphs from ancient Egypt or ancient Kemet, which is often not considered an African language, but this is very much an African language, and there are many other African languages that derive from that language. As you can see here, there are lots of these symbols that look very much like ancient Egyptian language, or Medunetra, as it's called, you know, if you, you know, have knowledge of that. So much of the Bamanankan's history is unwritten in and is preserved mainly through oral tradition. Why? Because the oral tradition is very, very important in traditional African societies, African American societies too, where we get that from, where we like to tell stories. We like to tell that story. And as time goes on, we like to continue to tell that story. But that is not unique, because many of the stories we have right now that we get even in United States history are narrations or attempts to explain some story in a particular way to appeal to a particular type of audience. And that is kind of the way history has been laid out. But of course, when it's African, it's assumed that, well, they're telling stories and they're just making stuff up. Well, you know, we can always make, we got plenty of examples of people making up stuff here, you know, George Washington chopping down cherry trees and Abraham Lincoln freeing slaves and so forth and so on. These are all, you know, oral stories that are narratives to justify a certain type of worldview. And so during the 18th century, two Bambara kingdoms existed in West Africa, the kingdom of Segu and the kingdom of Karata. However, in the mid-1800s, Muslim rivals overthrew their rule, and for many years, the warlords resisted Muslim occupation. One of the things that is often not explained about the history of Africa and what goes on in Africa is that while we see a lot of internecine war in certain areas of Africa today, mind you, certain areas, here's Africa that's a continent with 53 different nations, and there are little spats of warfare going on in a very, very minute area there. But we do not begin to see the kind of warfare that occurs right now until first the 6th, the 7th century when the Muslims come to Africa and Islam comes to Africa. Then we begin to see a lot of conflicts. And for 1,500 years, that is going on. And not only that, during that 1,500 years that that's going on, there is a trans-Saharan slave trade that's going on among Muslims in Africa. It is not until much later, roughly 1441, when the Portuguese come to Africa, that we begin to see the beginnings of the transatlantic slave trade. But the trans-Saharan slave trade, that 1,500 years, that's a part of history that we often don't talk much about, but that needs to be discussed. But then, early in the 20th century, the French gained control. Segu, and the Segu kingdom was a Bambara or Bamana kingdom founded along the Niger River from Bamako to Timbuktu. Bamako, along with Timbuktu, Jene, and Gao. These were the major cities along the Niger, major cities. I mean, Timbuktu, of course, was the intellectual center of the world during what they call the European Middle Ages. It was the major. There were only three major universities in the whole world at that time. One of them was the University of Sankore at Timbuktu. The other was the University of Salamanca in Spain, and the other was the University of Sevilla, also in Spain, in Al-Andalusia. I know I went to school there. All right? These were the main, and all of them were controlled by Africans when there was not a single university of at such level in Europe, because we don't begin to see the first real university in Europe come into existence until the time of the Medicis in Florence in Italy, when we get the Platonic Academy under the Medicis. And this begins what we think of as the Renaissance, the rebirth that occurs at this time. But this is where it was, and you had major writers and thinkers. In fact, they just recently at Northwestern University did took one of the math books that they used at the University of Sankore, and they took it to the Sorbonne, not Northwestern, but the Louvre. I mean, not the Louvre, but University of Paris Sorbonne, took the book back to the Sorbonne, and they investigated the book and found out that the math book was equivalent to a second year math class at the Sorbonne in Paris. And this was a book that goes all the way back to like the 12th or 13th century, a math book. And there are many, 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 many collections of books that they found there, many of which are being evaluated at Northwestern University right now. So, you know, it was very, very powerful. So, the Bambara Empire extended to include Timbuktu during the reign of Kalandian Koulibaly, who existed from 1652 to 82, but it disintegrated after his death. Of course, this is the famous mosque and University of Sankore at Timbuktu, and this is just kind of a modern kind of cool house that somebody built for themselves, you know, out of that African red mud, like brick mud and stuff that they have there, because it's everywhere. They kind of like down there in Mississippi, you know, where they got that kind of clay. You know what I'm talking about? Yeah, I think that's what kind of people were kind of drawn to while they were there. So, the founders of Mali, the Malinke, nation had been active in Ghana's gold trade in the 1230s. I put this picture up there because while we talk about a place like Bamako and Mali, some people fail to realize that, you know, this is Bamako right here. This is neighborhoods, you know, streets. Because oftentimes people think of Africa as that false image that we get on TV of what Africa is, and people starving, you know what I mean? Babies, bloated stomachs, and flies all around them, and shanty towns. And I always like to point out to people, we got people starving right here. And we got shanty towns right here. You know, this happens all over. But also, it is almost a disgrace that in the wealthiest nation on earth, that we have it right here. But yet they have, you know, people who are doing very, very well all over the continent like this. All right, so I wanted to throw that out there. All right, so the Bambara come to Louisiana French colonies. Louisiana census of 1708 did not count any Africans amongst the settlers. However, by 1712, there were 10 inhabitants of African descent. The remaining slaves to come to Louisiana would arrive directly from Africa and were brought to the region during the 1720s and the 1780s. Between 1719 and 1723, 2,083 slaves were imported to into the struggling French colony. Scholars of the slave trade have found that the trade in slaves is well documented by the French, not only in France, but also in Africa and on board the slave ships themselves. One of the problems we have here in the United States about documenting a lot of this information is that we don't want to go into the archives and take a look at what's there, because this was a business. But throughout the work of the French, the Dutch, the Portuguese, you got tons of documents available on this from the shipping capitals like Liverpool and Bristol. You have tons of documents in the islands, tons of documents. Places like here, like Bristol, Rhode Island, Newport, Rhode Island. They were major shipping ports, very significant. Tons of documents on this. But the way that they like to tell the story is that we don't know where people came from. We don't have any documents. We can't tell you anything. And those are all just fallacies, absolutely and completely, because the evidence is there. In the literature of the day, enslaved Africans were identified according to geographic location of their origins. And so here I put up a map. I don't know if you can see it too clearly here. But here are the vessels, the ships that brought Africans here. Here is the place where the voyage began. Here is the year that they arrived with slaves. Here is the first place slaves were purchased. You know, Ouida, St. Louis, Cabinda, Ouida again, St. Louis, Goree. All this is in the Senegambia area. You know, second place of purchase, right? Gariba, Ouida, Goree. Goree Island is right outside of Dakar in what is known as Senegal today. And they have a big slave fort there with the, you know, the door of no return and all the other kind of stuff there, all right? We have the third place of slave purchase. Again, Goree, Gambia, Bissau, St. Louis, all right? The total slaves embarked. How many did they put on each of these ships? First place slaves landed. Notice Louisiana, Biloxi, Grenada, Louisiana, Cap Français. All right, all of these places. It's right here, Martinique, New Orleans. Second place, New Orleans, Le Bassé, all right? Total slaves disembarked. 250, 250, 201, 200, 130, 127, 191, 149, 123, 240. You know, so you get an idea how many were picked up, how many didn't make it. And this is documented evidence on all of these voyages by all of these people who were engaged in this business. You know, the very idea that we have of waiting for your ship to come in. You didn't say, well, I'm waiting for my ship to come in. You know, when we say that, we mean we're waiting on our money to come when we get paid, right? Well, that idea comes from the slave trade, because investors in these various ships would wait for the ships to return for them to get their investment on their particular return from these ships. So Travel accounts throughout the region given by these various people identify Africans as Senegalese. In fact, that was a very common name for Africans in Louisiana. They were called Senegalese, since most of them came from the Senegal region. Bambara, and when I say Senegalese, I mean essentially the Wolof. The Wolof were very important, particularly Wolof women. Most slave owners preferred Wolof women because they were beautiful, they were statuesque, they wanted them. And they actually advocated for that. The Bambara, the Mandingos, the Fula, the Susu, and all these different groups were there, Igbo or Angola. In fact, you know down there in Louisiana, right, you know that the largest plantation, probably the largest penal penitentiary in the United States is what? Angola, right? And they call it Angola because that particular place was this huge plantation where most of the enslaved on that plantation came from the people of Angola. All right. So that these distinctions were noted, attested to the fact that the ethnic distinctions were being made between Africans, and they were well documented. So again, we have this distribution of slaves, and again, where they came from, the numbers, and so forth. Of course, the total of 13 million. I've always been challenged by the idea of 13 million because I know who thought up that idea, Philip Curtin, who's an Africanist. Scholar of the slavery and the slave trade, and I've always argued that he is off by several million, because estimates have been as high as 100 million. How could you, I mean, think about this. At this point, this is 13 million. How many of you African Americans are in the United States today? All right? What, we ain't moved that much since then? I mean, who are they fooling? So it's definitely much larger. It was much larger than that. And not to mention the many, 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 many who died, because the way it worked is that people were brought here, they got worked to death, and then they went and said, we need some more. And they went and brought some more. And they brought them here and they worked them to death, and then they said, we need some more. And they kept doing this. Imagine, we're only looking at one nation. That's the French. We're not considering the Dutch, the English, the Portuguese, and certainly later on, the Americans, who in fact got involved in the trade long after everybody else was talking about getting out. And the fact that we oftentimes don't want to acknowledge that the transatlantic slave trade to the Americas was not only the latest, but had the fewest people, and most of them were brought to this region that we're talking about right here. The fewest, not even a half a million were brought in to make this happen. So, upon arrival in Louisiana in 1719, many Africans encountered indigenous peoples as fellow slaves. They eventually formed alliances and occasionally escaped together toward the promised land, the promise of freedom. The French, seeing the potential for alliances between groups, would offer rewards in the form of goods to, you know, indigenous people, Native Americans, for returns of runaway slaves. So some of them got involved in assisting the French in being slave catchers. And they kind of gave them a bounty. But also, this was a divide and conquer strategy, because by ensuring that they could have the various indigenous people, Native American nations, support them in the capturing slaves, this meant that those people couldn't form alliances with the enslaved Africans to fight against the French. They were very, very concerned about that. So it was a very smooth divide and conquer strategy. So many of the earlier colonists could barely afford to pay for Africans who arrived at various entry points. For those who could not afford to pay for slaves in hard money, the Company of the Indies accepted paper money. If the colonists failed to pay off their debts, the slaves were returned to the company or paid for in kind, that is, in non-cash contributions paid for in services or goods. It was kind of like a trade deal. Okay, you can't pay your debts, then I own all your people, and then I could hire them out or rent them out to other people to do work, and I get paid for it. Times were so difficult for these early settlers that many sold their slaves to the Spanish and others in return for transportation out of the colony. Even though, if caught, they would be subject to a penalty of 1,000 lira and confiscation of their slaves. So it was very interesting. So in the process, and one of the things that happened after the rebellions is there was the creation of the Code Noir, or the Black Codes, that were established. During the administration of Governor Bienville, and in fact he's got a street named after him in New Orleans, The Code Noir Black Code was enacted, and if I had been thinking, I would have brought my copy of the Louisiana Black Code with me. 1724, to further limit the influence of Africans in the colonies and prevent desertion. Now, this is very, very important because the Code Noir is very, very similar to some of the stuff you see right now. Right now. In 60 articles, ensured that the movement of people of African descent were severely restricted. The status of those with darker skin was always lower than people of lighter complexion. Contact between racial groups was intentionally thwarted, and that instruction in the Roman Catholic faith was given to all the subjects. And this was very, very important as a form of control, as it were. And of course, in many cases, we found that the real support that many Africans received in the Catholic Church had to come from Black Catholics themselves, like Henriette DeLille and the DeLille sisters and the sisters organization she had, or from nuns who were Black who have their own convent. You can still go and visit it. And so you have many of them who were doing this kind of work there at this time. And mind you, these were Jesuits. The Jesuits, among the various orders of the church, that is the Catholic Church, the Catholico, you know, were and are the scholars of the church. You have many orders, the Capuchins, the Franciscans, and so forth, but the Jesuits are the scholars of the church. And guess who's a Jesuit? The Pope. And the Jesuits were very, very, very big in the Louisiana territories. Still are. Still are. So here are some of the things that they laid out in the code. Be it ordained by the police, jury of the parish of Saint-Laudre, that no Negro shall be allowed to pass within the limits of said parish without special permit in writing from his employer. Whoever shall violate this provision shall pay a fine of $2.50, or in default thereof shall be forced to work 4 days on the public roads or suffer corporal punishment as provided hereafter, which of course was meant that if you didn't have your pass to show that you were a citizen, you know, and prove that you could vote, then you would be punished by either A, being put on the chain gang to work, or you would get some type of other corporal punishment like whipping or something. No Negro shall be permitted to rent or keep a house within said parish. Any Negro violating this provision shall be immediately ejected and compelled to find an employer, usually a white employer, and any person who shall rent or give the use of any house to any Negro in violation of this section shall pay a fine of $5 for each offense. Now, y'all really pay attention to this. Because, see, this is what redlining looks like. But in a more severe situation. So you can't buy a house, you can't work, so you can't rent a house. And if you do get a house that's rented to you, then the house can be taken from you. And you got to find somebody who can vouch for you in order to say that is so. And then that person could be punished for renting you a house in any way. Every Negro is required to be in the regular service of some white person or former owner, who shall be held responsible for the conduct of said Negro. But said employer or former owner may permit said Negro to hire his own time by special permission in writing, which permission shall not extend over 7 days at any one time, which means you can work for somebody else to give them money, but you can't work for yourself. It's kind of another form of like sharecropping. No public meetings or congregations of Negroes shall be allowed within said parish after sunset. But such public meetings and congregations may be held between the hours of sunrise and sunset by the special permission in writing of the captain of the patrol. That is, you can't have a congregation, you can't meet up for religious service or any other kind of service, or any just a hangout, or just throwing a party without having permission from the police, within whose beat such meetings shall be in place. In accordance with Article 22 to 25, masters were to provide food, flour, cassava, which is a kind of a gourd-like plant, fish, fabric, and other provisions to ensure that their slaves were properly cared for and could therefore work productively. That is, let's give them the minimum amount, the least amount. The Code Noir also allowed slaves to report masters to the authorities if they were not given these provisions. However, although these articles were a part of the Code Noir, they were not always followed nor enforced, and many slaves resorted to running away. And Article 2 of the Code Noir, however, specifically addressed religion in the colonies by stating all slaves that shall be in our islands shall be baptized and instructed in the Roman Catholic and apostolic faith. The apostolic faith, this is Pentecostalism. That's what the Pentecostalism is all about, all right? The influence of the Roman Catholic tradition was felt especially among women and female children with the help of the Ursuline nuns. That's what I'm talking about, the Ursuline nuns, right? They were a black nunnery. They even actually have a convent that's in the French Quarter of New Orleans right itself, which the very famous Henriette de Lisle was one of the major nuns for. Converted people of African descent also played a role in the spread of Catholicism, and colonists in Louisiana territories could not afford runaways literally. So, but the consequence of this was this conspiracy. In 1731, not a whole lot of Africans came to Louisiana territories because of this conspiracy. This conspiracy in 1731 was what they called the Bambara conspiracy. And it was led by a man by the name of Samba Bambara, Samba the Bambara, who was considered very, very dangerous. Very, very dangerous. And the result of this conspiracy and other factors affecting the colony, the supply of enslaved Africans decreased because of those conspiracies, or what they call conspiracies, these revolts that occurred. And so this whole process of revolting has been very, very important. And it has a long, long history. And I think that even if you begin to study the history from way back then, going back to 1731, and going through over time, you begin to see that there has been a very serious issue with that. So what cultural influences did the Bambara have on African Americans and American society? Mandate speakers from the Santa Gambia region were recruited and preferred by planters for the unique agricultural experience. The uniqueness of Bambara culture was transferred to North America along with the Bambara themselves. There were specific references to the Bambara and runaway slaves in advertisements in South Carolina and in Georgia. Of course, the whole history of Georgia I don't need to go into right now, and the consequences of the Trail of Tears, because they wanted to kick the Cherokee out of their nation, which was in Georgia, so that they could bring, you know, enslaved Africans into the Georgia territories to increase the production of the South. The Spanish imported of Senegambia's, particularly Bambara, between 1700 and 1800s were about 30%. Bambara men often married Wolof, Igbo, and American-born, or they as Creole women. Since the Wolof and Igbo had the most women imported to the Americas, because these Wolof and Igbo women were considered very, very important to most slave owners. They wanted them as their had a name for them. They were called fancy ladies. You know, they were fancy ladies, and of course, we let you think about what that means. So the first two slave ships to arrive in Louisiana in 1719 brought rice seeds and Africans. Mind you, they didn't bring the Africans here and find rice here. They brought the rice seeds from Africa along with the Africans who could produce, who could cultivate the rice seeds and had them make that rice, or at least produce that rice. And it was the Bambara who knew how to cultivate them. Rice was consumed, but tobacco and indigo were exported. And so, and of course, later on, tobacco didn't work so good, and nor did indigo, so rice, and then much, much later after the cotton was involved. And so here's another thing. The New Orleans and Natchez were built by Africans. So many Senegambians were versed in the principles of statecraft. So I'm not going to go through this in a lot of detail, but all these different nations of Africans had established government where they came from. And they understood statecraft. They weren't a bunch of tribes running around kind of crazy in a bunch of grass skirts, as some people like to often portray them in the movies. It wasn't like that at all, as we can see from their dress in here. Bambara spirituality. This is very important, because oftentimes we think of Africans as practicing some type of idolatry or something like that. And I always tell people, how can you say Africans practice idolatry and you're walking around with a damn cross around your neck? You know, if it is true, if you're following Leviticus, Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5, where it says in there that you shall not worship anything that is in the heaven above, in the earth beneath, or in the waters under the earth. Nothing made of any graven image, wood or stone. But I guess that doesn't count because, you know, the Africans, they worship idols. All right. So the Bambara or Bamana believed in a supreme being called Ingala. Ingala created two principal deities, Pharaoh and Pemba. Pharaoh was master of the spoken word, created the seven heavens along with the spirit of air, Teliko. Pemba first assumed the form of a tree, after which woman was created as the earth, to whom was given a soul or knee and a double dia. Pemba proceeded to copulate with the earth and formed this union. From this union sprang animals and plants. A period of disorder was finally restored by the master of the spoken word, and from the Bambara, and for the Bambara, the soul, not only as it related to the African perspective on the afterlife, but also to the eventual conversion of Christianity, is important to understand. So what we see here when we look at Bambara spirituality, if you study anything or understand anything about ancient Egyptian or Kemetic spirituality, this is the same thing that they did and that they pushed and understand. And one of the really fundamental things that most people don't understand is that most traditional belief systems on the continent of Africa believe in a supreme being that no one can see or knows or that can be found. So as is true of the earth, humans also possess a soul or knee and a double or dia. Your double is your shadow that you walk with every day. The knee being the most important element of human existence. In addition to these two components, humans and animals as well possess a terre, or spiritual force, that is, that can be understood as your character, that part of your personality that is your essence, the thing that makes you you. At death, a dissociation takes place among the three elements of the human body. The dia enters into the realm of the water, the knee inhabits an ancestral altar, and the terre is transformed into the uninhabited entity called the Nyama, which roams about freely. That's that ancestor that you can call upon whenever in distress, that will always be around you at all times and in all places. So for the Bambara, there's an intimacy among the earth, the spiritual world, and the human being. So I have this little quote right here from Tony K. Bambara, all right, the great author. And what is religion, you might ask? It is technology of the living, all right? It is the technology of living. So African religion, old wine and new bottles. I'm just about wrapped up here. Just as Africans were imported into the French province of Louisiana, so too were their religions and religious beliefs. African religious beliefs, including knowledge of herbs, poisons, and the creation of charms and amulets of support and power, came to Louisiana with the earliest contingent of slaves. Court documents attest to the prevalence of charms and amulets and potions. You have gri-gri bags, right? That you wear. Some of you still care to have those things. Their grandparents make you a gri-gri bag, right? They stink too, but they're supposed to protect you. All right, and stuff like that. This whole practice of voodoo meaning really just a spirit of spirituality, is very, very important. And of course, at the bottom there, I have the picture of the great and famous Marie Laveau, all right, who is the queen of queens of what they call voodoo. My very, very close and best friend in the whole world is a descendant of Marie Laveau. He is a Glapion, all right? Very, very important person in the history down there and in this whole practice of what they call voodoo. So sometimes written voodoo or voodoom, the word itself means God creator or great spirit. That's what it means. It don't mean something evil. You know, you got all these movies that make it all bad when it's not all bad. It's not all about bad. It has been greatly distorted and misused. Human sacrifice, vampires, dripping blood, and devil worship all make the stuff of spooky novels and Hollywood movies, but this is not what the real voodoo is all about. All right? Influence on language. The successful maintenance of a particular worldview can only be enhanced by the preservation of the language in which the perspective was originally conceived. You do not have a worldview unless you have your own language to understand your own worldview. And when one learns a language, one learns a worldview. So say, for example, you know, I know Hebrew and I know Arabic, all right, but I also know that worldview. All right. I've learned some Wolof, so I'm learning about that worldview. And likewise, I speak American, so I know something about the American worldview. I always tell people we don't speak English because they speak English in Great Britain. You know, and if you think I'm kidding, just go there and stand on the streets of Liverpool or London or Bristol and listen to people talk. And you'll ask, what language is that they're speaking? They're speaking English. And they can clearly let know when you're speaking American. And so there's that real difference. But language is very, very important. Louisiana Creole belongs to a special language group called the Atlantic Creole. And one of the reasons why the language, it was so much emphasis was placed on taking the language away from us is because once you understand the language, you also maintain an understanding of yourself, because everything about yourself, everybody think about what makes you you, is embedded in your language. Your culture is in your language. How you do your food is in your language. How you live, how you speak, how you address your elders, how you address people younger than you, how you just live your life is all embedded in the language. And so the language is very similar in grammatical structure and pronunciation in literal translation and in literal translation of African idioms. Its vocabulary is overwhelmingly French in origin, but its grammatical structure is largely African. This is what the quote Creole language is. There is both a retention of specific African words and a syntactical continuity that allows these words to be expressed in an African linguistic context. As such, Louisiana Creole, as well developed long before the influx of people from Saint-Domingue or Haiti. As slaves in Louisiana. And so here we have examples I gave you here of various Louisiana. You had the Metoyer family, a very important Creole family in Louisiana. And then you have some Creoles in the middle, and then you have Creole at the bottom there. Because oftentimes we think of Creole as kind of light-skinned, but that's not what makes a person a Creole. And it's often misunderstood. All right, so here's some examples I give of various ways that the Creole language is used, the distinctions in terms of personal pronouns, possessive pronouns, tense markers, and so forth. In English, Louisiana Creole, Guadalupe Creole, Martinique Creole, French Guiana Creole. So they all have these particular differences. So let me conclude with this. The slave trade soon became a driving economic force of Natchez, and planters closely monitored the importation of Africans. William Dunbar inquired of the firm of Tuno and Price in Charleston, South Carolina, about their assistance to procure a certain number of African slaves in 1807. And so you had all these organizations, all these companies that were either personally involved in the acquisition of slaves, the Dutch East India Company, the French West India Company, and so forth, but you also had corporations who were responsible for making sure that those particular companies had other possessions done for them, like Brooks Brothers, who made clothes for slaves. You had Goldman Sachs, who were a major investment firm for engaging in slaves. And then, of course, you had to make sure that if something happened, that you could recoup your losses. So you needed Wells Fargo to ensure your losses. You needed J.P. Morgan to make sure that your losses were. So you had all of these different insurance companies. And we know all of these people. See, they all know. And what they did, and once they got here, they had to be sold some kind of way so some people could come up and invest in them. And so they created a slave market on what we call Wall Street today in New York City to engage in that process of selling these particular, and there's a monument to it right down there in New York on Wall Street. And then worse than that, when they got many of them who particularly came to New York, and this is kind of a sidebar right now, they put them in an area that they call Seneca Village. They took Seneca Village and destroyed it and created Central Park. If you didn't know, now you know. All right, so before the United States enacted the ban on the international slave trade, and by the way, even though there was a ban on the slave trade in the United States, Africans were still being brought to the United States well up into the 1860s. Because in Alabama, in Mobile, they have a neighborhood that they call Africatown. And Africatown is a neighborhood of the descendants of the last slave ship, the Clotilda, that was brought here to the shores of the United States. And the people who are descendants of the Africans on the Clotilda still live in that neighborhood today in Mobile, Alabama, and it's called Africatown. Of course, the Mobile, they were an indigenous or what we call Native American nation, too. And it's interesting to hear all these names because some of these people don't even exist anymore. They're gone, wiped off the earth. So Dunbar continued to describe the slaves he desired in detail, even addressing the required sex ratio among them. He also asked the traders not to procure slaves from the coast of Africa, but rather from the interior of the continent. See, that's how they would get the Bambara, because slaves from the African coast were less civilized than their fellow Africans. All right, so that's the name of the game. So hopefully you got some insights into just this one particular group of Africans that were brought to the United States. And we could do this for all of the other ones too. But this is just a short, really synopsis, a snapshot of what it was like for this one group of Africans who were brought to the Natchez area, and I'm certain were those who were sold at the forks of the roads in Natchez, Mississippi.